You've landed Inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello, innovators. Your host, Tamara here. Excuse the voice. I have a head cold and I sound all funny and congested. I can't believe 2019 is almost over. I have no idea where it went. Do you? I feel like I say that every year. Now I'm guessing, like me, you are beginning your prep for 2020. You're ambitious. You're an innovator, right? December is really the time to think about that, not waiting until January. And maybe it's just mulling over what you've accomplished, what you wish you accomplished. Maybe you've bought your 2020 journal or even started writing down your goals. Whatever stage you're in, I'd like you to consider adding how to dial up being an everyday innovator onto your list of how you tackle 2020. In fact, at the top of the list, because 2020 is only going to be faster and more complex than 2019. The competition for relevancy at all levels is only going to be more fierce. And how you innovate is how you stand out from the crowd. It's how you provide your highest value and solve those big sticky challenges so that you can get to those goals that you set in 2020. Now, how do you do that, you ask? Well, simple. I don't like to leave you hanging. You know that. So go to our website and click on training for the individual in the navigation bar. So it's training is up at the top. And then if you click on it, it says for individuals, click on that. We'll put a link in the show notes too. But that'll give you access to everything you need to innovate and win in 2020. It'll all be at your fingertips. We're going to make it so easy for you because it should be easy. Being innovative really isn't that hard if we just put our mind to it, be intentional about our natural strengths, and do it every day. Being innovative isn't a nice to have. It's a must. And that's awesome because as we've proven in our work, it's not if you innovate, it's how you innovate. And innovation is your competitive advantage. All right, on to the interview. So I wanted to understand how big teams and companies tackle growth strategies. I think all of us in our jobs, whether we are kind of on the front lines or in leadership or own our own businesses, we're kind of looking to growth, making a positive impact, moving things forward. So I wanted to understand how some of the best do that. And oftentimes, particularly if you work within a larger team, that needs to include something that you're not really used to doing, which is moving faster, being more nimble, making quicker decisions, basically acting like a startup. So I invited Chris Work onto the show. He's the managing director at Accenture Strategy, where he leads competitiveness in zero-based cost management areas in North America. We'll dig into that. He works with leaders of consumer packaged goods, industrial and retail companies, helping them drive enterprise value through innovative growth strategies, operating model design, and structural cost resets. Now, I know that sounds like a lot of big language, but Chris and I really dig in to understand how you actually apply this zero-based method to everything that you're doing. And it's a way of thinking about growth and innovation that isn't just negative or isn't just pulling stuff away or isn't just dumping money into something either. So I know it's kind of big, fancy words, but believe me, we break it down. He's also the co-author of The Big Zero, a book that outlines how organizations can achieve startup speed at enterprise scale through a modern form of zero-based budgeting. So that's what I was just kind of talking about. So startup speed, big companies. Now, all of us need to move quicker, need to be more nimble, need to be more innovative. So this really applies to all of us. Okay.
Chris, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
So tell us, what's your first memory of being innovative?
You know, I thought a lot about the topic in general. You know, I've always been an ideation type person. Going back to as young as I can remember, I grew up largely with a Montessori education in primary school, and it gives you a lot of room to kind of experiment and do your thing. And so I've always just enjoyed logic, the way that pieces come together, the way that numbers flow. And probably, you know, the most innovative thing I can imagine as a kid, there's something about the way that countries organized their counties and states, and why I knew the name of every state of every country in Africa. I'm still not sure. However, I did, and I started to redraw maps as a kid in kind of a very imaginative way. And so that's probably the first memory I have of what I'll call innovation, but it's, you know, reimagining things in new ways.
Well, first of all, I'm so glad you mentioned Montessori. I sent both my kids to Montessori early, preschool. And I will tell you, what I always loved about it and wish we did more as adult was that more holistic problem solving. So instead of, you know, it being kind of, you were alluding to it, math versus English versus science, you know, versus whatever. It was like, oh, pick a topic that you love and all those things kind of come out of it. And I think we've lost, as adults, we talk ourselves out of doing things that way. It's kind of interesting.
Well, I think there's two elements. So one is it teaches curiosity because you're not being forced to do something and you enjoy what you discover through curiosity. I think that's one real big power of it. And the other piece of it is I think it teaches a little bit of intellectual courage because you're not governed. You know, for me, I have always excelled in math and science and probably lagged a bit in English. And so for me, it was allowing me to lean in further on some of those STEM type skills, but still dragging me through the areas where I didn't have the same energy. So I'm a big advocate. I think particularly early in life, it teaches some very good skills.
I love that phrase, intellectual courage. And I think it's a great way to think about when you're doing something that's out of what you would perceive as out of your skill set or out of your experience, to think about almost, I don't know if I'm saying this right, so maybe you can elaborate, but almost attaching it to something else that you feel more confident about, so that, to kind of your point, you can have a little bit more of a halo effect.
I think so. And it gives you the tolerance to take on risk that I think otherwise needs to develop in different ways.
Yeah. So before, you have a book that I really am looking forward to digging into, but before we do that, I want to set the stage a little bit. So from your perspective, how is business changing? And most importantly, what impact does that have on the speed in which we need to do business?
Wow, what a bold question.
I'm just going to start with the Oprah question and then we're going
to I'll try to discern it to a couple of specific areas, I guess. You know, I think first and foremost, this notion of trust is prevalent in a way that I can't ever remember. And we see trust in the way that particularly the younger generation of workers choose employers to, I'll choose engage with. You know, the commitment is no longer there. And so it's a choice to where they engage and spend time. We see trust in the way that ecosystems are evolving. You know, channel partners are working upstream, suppliers are coming downstream. We see trust in the way that regulators are starting to behave. We see trust in the way that investors view company. And I think what digital has done is it's elevated transparency to the point where we can no longer avoid it. And there are companies that, you know, we've seen, they're actually putting trust into the way they compensate their executives, which I think is fascinating. The second piece I see is just the role of technology more broadly. And, you know, I think earlier in my career, you would think about technology as being an operational enabler, not necessarily a revenue enabler. And I'm not talking about e-commerce type stuff. I'm talking pure insights. You know, how can some of the most innovative product companies in the world be harnessing insights in both a structured and very unstructured way to fundamentally reshape how they think about the innovations they're bringing to market? That's a totally different view of technology. The way that workers engage and collaborate with one another, I personally use a Microsoft platform, and just the way the teams is late has really changed the way that I work. So it's an interesting element of it. And then there's expectations around volatility that I think we've never had to deal with before. And so the way that CFOs in particular, but boards think about managing risk and resiliency. There were words that I think 10 years ago we didn't talk as much about, but all these themes are now at the forefront.
There's a couple things I want to dig into here before we move on, because I think they're so important and they're kind of layered into all this great insight. So one is when we talk about trust, I just want to get your definition of it, because I think much like innovation, vulnerability, a lot of these words have a lot of different meanings to people. So start with that. Talk to me about what you mean by that.
Well, I think trust comes down to whether or not you're willing to engage in a relationship. So as a professional services organization, do my clients trust me to create value for them? Do my employees trust me to create a compelling and engaging place to work? When I think about the ecosystem players I work with a number of research organizations. I also partner with other professional services organizations, even partner with some companies down industry in the work I do. And, you know, how do we create joint value together? So I think trust is this notion of collaboration and partnership to me at its core. Yeah.
And this may be an obvious question, but I don't want to leave this side of it out. What are the consequences of diminished trust?
We've put some research out there I think is pretty compelling. I mean, billions of dollars of shareholder value at the most extreme level. And I'm not just talking about a breach in data security or an issue that a pharmaceutical company may have with the security of its products. Little things, just the way relationships evolve. I mean, it could have a 10, even 20% impact to the way an organization operates. And then you look at the predictability. We're likely entering a recession. The question is how deep and how long. One of the companies I spend a lot of time watching in the industries that I play around, you know, has lost 70% of its value in just the past 4 months because of their inability to communicate effectively with the investment community. Fundamentally, it's the greatest buy I see in the market. But because they don't have trust in the way they engage the community. So I think that collaboration and transparency and engagement, without it, it's very difficult to attract the financial and talent resources you need.
So let's dig. So because your book is fantastic, first of all. So let me just say that. It's called The Big Zero. We'll put a link in the show notes to it. But it outlines how organizations can achieve startup speed and enterprise scale, which as you and I are kind of talking about with this whole trust, which may sound like a tangent, but Launch Street, that really is at the foundation of being able to do those two things. So talk to us about your book. What is The Big Zero? Like, how does that work, getting that startup speed and enterprise scale?
The notion of the book, it came out of this notion of a lot of companies over the past, call it 5 to 8 years, have created significant shareholder value through cost reduction. And there's a term that's you know, becoming more widely accepted called zero-based budgeting. And it elevates the earnings potential in a very dramatic way, but it felt incomplete to us. When we really think about the competitiveness of organizations, and we study thousands of organizations and how they're evolving along these dimensions of growth and trust and profit, we felt like there's a new management model that is needed, badly, badly needed. And so the whole notion of The Big Zero is moving from a term called zero-based budgeting to a zero-based mindset. And in its simplest terms, what it is if you think about all the resources that an organization has, whether it's a for-profit or not-for-profit organization, they have this pool of cash that they deploy. And how do we figure out the allocations of that? What are those things that drive the business strategy, create value for employees, for suppliers? How do we amplify that, or at least right size it? But in many cases, it's been underinvested. And how do you fund that by taking all this other cash and pool of resources and compressing it to what's really needed? So let me give you an example. Finance organizations. Historically, many finance organizations have been process inadequate, very unstandardized, heavy Excel-based ad hoc reporting. Well, the reality is the way that some of the technology platforms have evolved in the market, you can broadly digitize finance. That resets the cost of a finance organization by magnitudes lower. All right, so what do you do with those dollars? And one of my clients, which is a consumer products company, they chose to put it back in new product innovation and marketing. So that's an example of resetting your cost base to fuel growth. There's also an element to the book, which is the concept isn't that hard to grasp, but the execution is. And so you know, we've been very active in the market, I'd argue the leader for a number of years. And too often, we're taking our clients through the journey. And so in many ways, it's a playbook. It helps our clients and the broader business community understand exactly how you move from point A to point B in adopting the zero-based mindset.
So this is so good. So I have so many questions. Okay, where to start? So let me go back to the beginning of this section, which was you had said the zero-based budgeting felt incomplete. What specifically was missing from that, or what wasn't working for the clients that you were working with?
Well, I think the most obvious missing piece was the reinvestment towards growth. So if a company were to go find $500, $1 billion of existing expense and cash flow that can be optimized or released, too many companies are just pumping that back into stock repurchases, higher dividends, increasing the earnings of the company. And that's why we saw a lot of share prices really explode from, call it 2013 or 14, up through 17 and 18. But at the end of the day, many of these industries are getting disrupted. So again, a lot of my background is consumer goods. And, you know, for years, we'd say that a benchmark is that 1% of your revenue should be spent on research and development expense, which is one of your core innovation pipeline engines. I would argue that number is going to 2% very quickly. Or we might say that your advertising and marketing expense, you know, very analytically, would be 6 to 8%. I would argue that's going to elevate by at least 25, if not 50%, to engage with consumers in a more effective way. And so as the money was being saved, it wasn't a balanced reallocation. Yes, some should go back to shareholders, but I think a lot more needs to go to the long-term viability of the organization. And so that's a bit of what was missing.
If I hear you right, it's really kind of, so all that cost cutting and all that shaving, it looks great on the P&L in the moment, but what it doesn't do is set you up for success in the future or for growth in the future.
That's right.
Okay. And I love that. I wanted to take a moment there because I think for Launch Street, a lot of the innovators on this podcast are leaders in their organizations. I think even if you think about at the scale of how you run your team, there's a big difference between momentary success and long-term and strategies that lead to long-term growth, which is really what you're talking about.
That's right. And when you look at all of the most valuable companies in the world, you just segment, take the top quartile. Most of it's driven off of the future value expectations.
Right.
And I don't care if you're in, you know, a very mature industry, you know, in quotes, like consumer goods, or one that's being radically disrupted like retail right now. Every industry is going to be disrupted. It's just a question of when. And is it incremental? Is it slowly compressed over time? Or is it a big bang that comes out of left field? And not enough companies, even today, not enough companies are thinking enough about when and where disruption will occur and how to reset before that happens.
Well, and it's been my experience. I've done a lot of work also in consumer packaged goods. It's been my experience that it's never actually out of left field. It's just that they weren't paying attention to the right places.
That's right.
Until it hit them too hard for them not to notice.
Well, and you know, there's a cautionary lesson from 2008 to 2010, which, you know, as we inch towards some sort of economic volatility here that will get deeper. What we know from the past is the companies that had the capacity to invest more intensely than they had been through that period skyrocketed on the other end of it.
Oh, that's really
interesting. So here we sit at an inflection point. And we have a choice. And so that's really what the book's all about. It's how do you create that financial and operational flexibility?
So let's dig into that. Because the other thing you said that I think was so powerful that I'd love to go deeper into, which is going from that zero-based budgeting to zero-based mindset. Talk a little bit about that shift, what that looks like.
Well, the words are important. Budgeting is a very finance-driven word. Mindset's a cultural one. And so while most of the time we'll find that CFOs are the ones that would champion this type of a management model, the reality is it is a radical cultural shift that has to start from the top, whether it be a CEO or board of directors. So the idea of the mindset is, you know, in a budgeting exercise, it's just that we can build a series of systems and controls and we can execute it, but it doesn't facilitate creativity in how you think about resource allocation. It doesn't facilitate the flexibility to react very quickly when something happens. It's a governance model. And what the mindset is all about, it's about making sure you have the visibility at all times so that when you see a great opportunity, you can double down quickly. Or maybe something that you plan to happen hasn't, and you can pull back very quickly. And so the best companies in the world at this are constantly reallocating budget and capital resources across P&Ls. It's fun. It's almost like a dynamic system in play. And as a result, they're better places to work. Their customers are more engaged. Their channel partners love them because they're able to do things that create collective value that others cannot. And that's very innovative to me.
I want to ask you a question about the dynamic part of it. So I was just reading Nine Lies by Marcus Buckingham. And yeah, it's a great book. But one of the things that I was fascinated by and believe in, but I think he did a great job of articulating it, is, you know, there's only so far out into the future you can plan without having the ability, the system, and I think to your point, the mindset of dynamically looking at things on a regular basis so that you can actually adjust as the real world adjusts, because it turns out you put your plan on paper and the world keeps moving and your plan is set. So when you think about that dynamic side of it, of what you were just talking about, how does that play out? How does that actually look?
Well, I mean, I'll give you two examples. And they both play to the notion of optionality. So you know, both are going to be heavy manufacturing-based companies. One company was struggling for a decade with its performance, has gone through a multi-year transformation. They have rewired their entire operations and cost structure and secured long-term contracts in highly attractive markets, which was all great until those highly attractive markets took what is probably a 2 to 3 quarter blip. Now, on the other side, it's going to be fine. But right now, they don't have the optionality to reallocate resources because they've distributed dollars and they distributed talents. And they distributed investments with their customers in a way that is very structured and rigid. That is not a zero-based mindset. A different heavy manufacturing company is, and the leader, hands down, the number one market share leader in their industry, is stepping back and saying, what if our customers want to move from a transactional to a partnerial model? The industry's never gone down a partnerial path, but what would that look like? And how different would our world need to look? And one of the things we came to is, I mean, it could be a 5x increase in the number of engineers they need. Okay, that's a pretty fundamental issue in a world that has not enough engineers. And so they're starting to think about fundamentally different ways of rewiring the organization and the way they operate and the role that different partners outside this enterprise can play. And that's agility. They don't know what's going to happen and when, but they're preparing for that scenario. They're preparing for another one where the pressure and intensity of a recession massively compresses margins. And what is their fallback if they have to? And then they're preparing for a third where that same recession could greatly devalue a number of smaller players in the industry. And what would have to be true to be able to very quickly roll up the industry and potentially grow by 50% in their scale? And so that's the kind of agility or optionality that I believe competitive companies want to hold.
How do you go from, and maybe it's not from one simply to the other, maybe it's not that linear, but from rigid to agile mindset? So what I'm hearing you say, right, with the zero-based mindset is you've got to be agile and open. You've got to ask those challenging questions about doing things differently. I think you said it earlier, like all of us are going to be disrupted at some point. We've got to be on the lookout for that all the time. It's happening everywhere in every industry. So how do you get if your clients come to you to do this work, how do you get them from the place of rigid, this is the way it's always been done, to that agile mindset that keeps you learning and growing with that eye on disruption in the future?
You know, for me, probably three books in my life that I would say, at least business books, that are really, really influential. And American Icon and the way that Ford was really stabilized and turned around has had such an impact in how I think about engaging with my clients and advising, you know, our teams to work with clients. And the turnaround, the way that Alan turned around Ford is it was extreme visibility. He took data and dashboards and elevated the whole management team so everyone could see what's going on and they can make choices. And so I think it all starts with visibility. in the large global organizations many of us are in, you have fiefdoms and you have a disincentive to share information. And if you look at what makes the startup community so powerful and so exponential, another phenomenal book that's had a big impact on how I think about exponential organizations, they, from the core, are flexible and dynamic. And so I think it starts with the CEO setting a direction that we're going to be transparent.
The transparency, I think it goes back to what you were saying about trust too, because transparency leads to more trust when people actually know what's going on versus feeling like they're being left out or don't have the information they need to make smart decisions or whatnot. But I have to imagine that that takes a very bold, to your point about kind of leadership, that takes a very bold move to be willing to put more information out on the table for people.
It is. Well, you know, I'll tell you, clearly I'm a little biased, but I tend to think that Accenture is one of the best managed organizations in the world. And the thing that blows me away is we are transparent to the extreme. I mean, we're data at our fingertips. And we will have open discussions on one part of the business is just explosive in growth, and another one's struggling, and let's talk about reallocation of resources. Mm. And they're open and transparent and blunt conversations. They don't always feel great, but because the data is there, it's hard to argue the facts.
Right.
And
right.
That leads me to a second. Right. We definitely have. So it leads me to a second point then, which is if you start with transparency, the next is the way that you think about talent development and the way that you reward and incent people. And so the profile of a leader is very different than we saw 5 years ago. And we talk a lot about a whole brain leader. Yes, executives need to be very analytical, but they need to also be very human centric. They need a coach. They need to help give people the courage and reward and recognize risk-taking, smart risk-taking, even when it doesn't work out. And there are still way too many organizations that are consequence-driven. So to me, that's kind of the point two. And then I think point three is, I think we have to collectively, as a community, both businesses and not-for-profits, create a lot more investment capacity for organizations to experiment. And I think, again, you can look to the startups of the world, the Googles of the world for inspiration, but we don't see enough experimentation as a theme. And that's something that, you know, interestingly, the youngest generation coming into the workforce loves and is great at. I'm always blown away at how much more creative, you know, a person 3 to 5 years out of school may be. And I will step back and say, sure, I have all this industry and institutional knowledge. Well, they're asking questions because they don't know any better, which also means they have the courage to think differently. And we're not doing enough to foster that as a broad business community.
You know, and I would add to that and say that what I also greatly appreciate with the ones on my team is that they don't hesitate to ask those questions and challenge those assumptions. And they don't have that same, I'm a Gen Xer. So I grew up in the age of like, you did your due diligence before you were allowed to speak. And they just have that. So they're just so empowered to speak. So, which I love, but it's their naiveness that actually leads to your point that leads to different thinking, which is such a blessing if we take advantage of it versus getting frustrated by it.
Yeah, I very much agree.
Yeah. So I want to ask you a question about digging a little bit more about the talent development. And you were talking about kind of recognizing and being a coach and a mentor. And one of the things that I believe very strongly, and I've seen a lot in my career is, you know, organizations that reward behaviors, not outcomes, are far more innovative and hence have a greater competitive advantage. So versus waiting for, I always joke about it's like the failure shelf or cake on Friday. You know, it's either because it succeeded or failure. It's either one of the two, right? And we wait until the end to put a spotlight on what happened versus saying, oh, well, we want more smart risk taking, regardless of where it even goes. Let's reward people for the behavior that we're looking for versus the outcome. And kind of to your point about talent development and being a mentor and a coach, what advice do you have for those people stepping into leadership roles? Because it takes training to be a good leader. Not everybody is innately good at it, regardless of intention. What is your advice to them to be more of that whole brain leader you were talking about?
I think if we just spent 20% of our time listening, it would go a long ways. Mm-hmm. I find executives, you know, our diaries are packed. you know, I joke with a woman on my team that half my day is running 15-minute increments. And we've built some good discipline, though, where I have 2 hours a day that it's on my calendar. It's called reflection, and it's very protected. And I use it to talk to people and listen, and I'm not even coaching. But I think by listening, you open up your mind to understand. And if you don't have that headspace, there are certain leaders that are special and can operate without it. But if you don't have it, I think it's too easy to fall in the trap of just execution. And if you're in a pure execution mindset, you're not taking the time to recognize the really great things going on around you.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is really powerful. And to add a layer to that, if we can listen openly, try to get rid of some of that confirmation bias that we hold of, you know, judging what does and does not fit our current thinking model, and actually saying, hey, if I were looking for a different way to think about this, and then going out and asking, so that you're truly open to other people's perspectives versus just, you know, walking down the halls.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I want to ask you, in the book, you mentioned the baby Z's. Walk us through some of those. What is that?
It's great marketing. I'll start with that. It's a very simple framework that we can use to explain the P&L. And so, you know, we'll start at, think about the structure of a P&L from revenue down to the cost of goods sold and into SG&A. There's four of them. And really, we could argue there's an element of capital that's not appropriately captured in them, but I think it's implied in many ways. So the first one is zero-based commercial, and it's the way that you really think about rebalancing commercial investments. Sure, there are organizations that are in deep turnarounds and probably need to contract a bit in the way they think about marketing innovation and the way they price and promote in the market. But many organizations, far more than those that are in restructuring, are growing. And smart allocations. And so zero-based commercial is about great visibility to where to play, how to win type choices, and how are you investing resources against them. And you know, I'll take those categories. Too many organizations think about innovation, marketing, and pricing is three very discrete pools of investment. The reality is they are right. One and the same. And so rebalancing around that's a really powerful construct. The second one is zero-based supply chain. And we could tailor supply chain based on industries. So for example, if there's a health provider, it'd be more operational in nature. If we're getting into retail, we're thinking more about stores. But zero-based operations or zero-based supply chain is really about what I'm going to call should costing in the core operations of the business. And should costing takes two dimensions. One is just how do your relative assets perform against one another? And what can you learn from a leading practice standpoint that should be shared? And I'll give you an example. One company that I worked with had, you know, just over 90 discrete manufacturing facilities. And while they had a continuous improvement program, it was localized. And just by elevating up the operational excellence notion across the whole set of assets, it was a very significant unlock of value. The second piece is around the shift cost of digital and just the way that technology is coming into the supply chain. It's creating very different ways to operate and very different expectations for what the cost of operations should look like. The third is around zero-based spend. And think about this as your overhead general administrative non-payroll spend. Some companies call it indirect spend or goods not for resale. And that's about managing the consumption and the price balance. I think for many companies, it's always been about price. So the reality is we find that almost 70% of the value actually sits in contracting consumption. So if you take the analogy of pencils, sure, I could reduce the price of a pencil by 5%, but the reality is why am I buying so many pencils in the first place? And right. Earlier in the discussion, you talked about compressing non-working versus working dollars, or you know, the non-working being the stuff that doesn't directly add value. The zero-based spend is a lot of the non-value added spend. The last one, which is I believe not necessarily the largest money, but potentially for a number of industries, the most transformative is zero-based organization. And as industry is changing, as disruptions occurring, operating models fundamentally need a shift. And so zero-based organization reimagines the right work for an organization and what it should be sized at or cost at to execute against that. And so if I use a heavy manufacturing example, if I need to increase the number of engineers by 5X, well, that requires me to rebalance from somewhere else. So what are the offsetting changes I make? And so what we tend to find is that there is, you know, no surprise, too much overhead and administrative burden. And how do you get more of the organizational investment focus on customers and value chain partners and innovation? And so those are the four baby Z's.
So I want to ask you about how, if I'm listening to this, and I was just kind of, as you were talking about these things, I was thinking to myself, gosh, you know, I bet if I looked, if I were the in the C-suite of a large organization, whether that's manufacturing or food development, whatever, and I'm looking at it, I'm going, wow, I have a really bloated management level. Like if I looked at it, right, it's not even a triangle. There's like a bulge out in the middle. That might be an indicator that I need to move and shift some things around to get more growth and more innovation and more success in the future. And it got me to think of, well, what are some of those other indicators that, hey, I really need to think about the zero-based mindset? And obviously, it's great for a lot of organizations, but what are some of those flags that you've seen that clients should be looking at to go, I need to really explore this now?
That's a great question. You know, I walk down the stack that I just articulated the baby Z's in. The biggest one for me on the commercial side is three questions. One is, do I have clarity on where I want to play in the market based on profit pools of potential? Second that builds upon that is, do I then understand how well I'm performing in the spaces I am playing? So the profitability and the growth trajectory. And it's amazing to me how many companies don't have that visibility. I was with a company just a few weeks ago that said, I can't tell you how many salespeople I even have, not to mention who they're focused on. And then the third one is, do you understand the right trade-off between innovation and marketing? Not enough organizations understand the balance that really optimizes their potential. So that's one set of signals commercially. On the supply chain side, you know, there's a number of maturity factors, but the biggest one is if there's not a clear technology agenda that's driving the future supply chain, that's probably a signal it's time to think about a zero-based mindset. You know, different companies have different views on how they look at the network of their assets or, you know, do they have someone else operating for them or not. But technology should be at the core, at least in my mind, of any supply chain or operation. And so that's a good signal that there's broad opportunity. On spend, if organizations don't talk about consumption in a disciplined way, that is a flag that there is a significant opportunity. And it's never ceases to surprise executives when they find out how much consumption they have and what their peer group of zero-based mindset companies do. And just the immediacy of that unlock is great. And then organizationally, I think most high-performing organizations rethink their operating model. You know, every, call it 3 to 7 years, depending on the degree of disruption, where they are on their growth journey. But, you know, intelligence is not at the core of the way that an organization is operating. And so I'm talking data and machines that allow you to move in a far more agile and in disciplined manner. That's a good signal that there's potential. And that's not just at a functional level, because I think the real unlocks are really the cross-functional interactions. And yeah. So are you thinking end-to-end about outcomes, or are you thinking about the cost of running a sales organization? They're very different frames of reference. So those are some signals that they exist, but you know, really, if there's not a conversation that starts each year at the boardroom says, how should we be thinking about reallocating 10 to 20% of our resources to our growth priorities? That overarching question is probably a good signal that maybe it's a time for some different thinking.
Before we have to move on, what do you mean when you say the trade-off between innovation and marketing?
For a lot of companies, the past 20 to 30 years, so I think big established organizations, growth has occurred through distribution, acquisition of new customers, entry into new geographies, new channels to market. For a number of the largest organizations in the world, call it the 1,000, 2,000 largest companies, they have clarity on the market they want to play in. They're running out of headroom to just expand distribution. And we could market very effectively. And in some cases, it works well. I mean, this is the beauty of these young high-growth companies is they have a very innovative platform, and they just bring it to market in very creative ways and it explodes. And I think marketing still works well there. But for these very established organizations, innovation, you know, products becoming solutions and services, the way that joint ventures start to take shape, I personally believe we don't see enough of that balance of investment going to reinventing the portfolio. We're still very cautious and saying, let's keep reinforcing the portfolio. And I think in 2 to 3 years' time, we may find that if that's not addressed, it becomes an Achilles heel for many companies.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it kind of leads me to my next question, which is, in your work, what do you think stops individuals, and in this case, I'd probably elevate it to companies too, from truly innovating?
Well, if I'm sitting on a multi, $100 million product or service, or even a multi-billion-dollar product or service, I'm very content. Mm-hmm. I'm managing around the margins. A few more points of growth, offset a little bit of cost, lift up the gross margin on the product by, 30, 40, 50 basis points. I'm operating the business. There's a lot of downside to saying, let's go disrupt ourselves. And so that's where I think the intellectual curiosity becomes so important. Are you spending enough time thinking about new business models? Yes, we need to drive today's core with extraordinary excellence. I'm not disputing that. But is enough time going to thinking about the future? And are we making that pivot effectively?
Yeah, it's really interesting what you're saying about comfort and complacency. And I interviewed someone who was a conductor for an orchestra. But he took teams through it. And one of the things he was telling me was that when the orchestra plays and everybody's at 70%, so they're just getting by, they're doing what they need to do to keep the boat moving forward, it sounds fine, but it's not until you see what everyone playing at their optimal way, where you hear the orchestra at its best, that you notice the difference. So it's so easy to skate by at 70%, to your point, like just kind of playing around the margins before you even have to face, until some disruption comes along, face the fact that you got to start playing differently.
Totally. It's funny. There are some, the very innovative companies actually talk to the investment community about the amount of revenue from new product introduction. Mm. Why aren't more management teams and boards talking about this?
Yeah.
Why is it not a primary KPI in the scorecard? And I think when you put that focus, you get an outcome that you're looking for. But if you say, how does the broad P&L look, that alone doesn't move you to the future.
Right. Well, then the conversation shifts to how do we stay relevant when things have already changed, basically, which is a whole different conversation.
Exactly.
Before we have to close out, where can people go to learn more, get the book, connect with you?
We'll start with it. I think the book is a very helpful reference guide to think about adopting the Big Zero. And Accenture has a wealth of resources available that any simple search will find for you as well. My contact information is there, and so they can get me. My email is christopher.r.rourke@accenture.com. And yeah, I have a lot of fun. I was just down in Houston talking about the Big Zero across the oil and gas industry. We're going to spend some time in New York and in London coming up here over the next couple months. And so I'm always excited to engage around this topic because I'm so passionate about where I think the potential lies here.
Well, Chris, it's been very insightful, but I what I really appreciate is the mindset of moving from like, how do I just shave costs, make the P&L look good today, to how do I really leverage my resources to continue to grow and to continue to stay relevant in a changing, disrupting marketplace. And I think that in some ways, surprisingly, in some ways not, is a big shift for a lot of organizations who are, that old phrase, like what got you here won't get you there. I mean, that's ultimately the inflection point that we're at, is you simply cannot do what you did yesterday and make it work. So, but that takes a shift, a fundamental shift in how you view the focus and the priorities, which is a lot of what you're talking about, which then ultimately I think leads to mindset. Okay, what's your final piece of advice for innovators on Launch Street?
Yeah, I think just listen and have the courage to think in a way that demonstrates to your peers and those around you in the organization that you accept risk.
very quickly on risk, because I'm so glad you said that about accept risk, because I think a lot of people say they want to accept risk, but don't know, or afraid, first of all. And second, don't know what accepting risk really looks like. If you were just high level to say, hey, this is how I know you truly accept risk, what would that look like?
I think for me, it is being very transparent. You know, I have an idea or a hypothesis or a concept, and I'm going to lean into this, and here's the range of outcomes, and regardless of which one of the outcomes we get to, what's more important is what we learn about that bet or that choice we're going to make than necessarily the specific outcome it is. And so I think just the way you frame that discussion, and I would hope that more management teams would be talking about the best and the risks that they're going to take as part of the regular cadence.
Yeah, and I think it's a really different and interesting and frankly important conversation to have around what the realities of the risks are versus trying to minimize it to the point where you've actually minimized the potential of the work you're doing as well. Chris, thank you so much for joining me today. That was absolutely insightful. It's really made me sit back and think how I'm allocating resources and how I'm thinking about the dollars in particular and making sure that I'm not getting trapped in a short-term mindset. So I think that was very powerful for our listeners. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, Tamar.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.